my name is Nicole Colton. I'm going to be chairing the meeting tonight. Sherry Wolf is going to be speaking for 35 or so minutes. Sherry is a long-standing member of the ISO and a member of the editorial board of the International Socialist Review. So we're very pleased to have her speak tonight, and I will turn it over to Sherry.
Okay, let's kick it off, and if it gets noisy, I will ask you to close the door because I get distracted. But also keep in mind, I'm also the only one in here with a turtleneck on, so if you're hot, I'm hotter. Basically, I think to look at the situation today in Palestine is really to gaze upon an attempted mass genocide in slow motion. 57 years of oppression, of occupation, slander, the thievery, and the denial of even their own humanity of the Palestinian people. I think in the Western world, at least gives me gives us a sense of outrage about what has happened to the Palestinian people, and the fact that they struggle nonetheless, to me, is a testament to the fact that human beings can be remarkably resilient and unbelievably brave. The recent myth that Israel was disengaging from the Gaza Strip and in the southwest of Israel, what is known as probably the largest concentrated slum, open-air slum, anywhere in the world, of 1.4 million Palestinians at least, most of whom are now living at the behest of the International Red Cross. That is pretty much the only means through which most people there are fed. The notion that under Sharon, under Prime Minister Sharon of Israel, a man who is long known as the butcher of Sabra and Shatila of the refugee camps 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago in southern Lebanon, who oversaw a mass genocide of thousands of Palestinians, this is the man who leads the state of Israel. The notion that he had somehow negotiated and led disengagement on the behest of the Palestinian people is an outright lie. In fact, what they have turned it into is an open prison camp where there are no settlers and where there is no Western press to actually watch what is taking place today. And if people want to be up on the current story of what's happening in the Gaza Strip, I strongly encourage folks to pick up the current issue of Socialist Worker with a brilliant page-long piece on the ongoing occupation by Taufik Haddad, a comrade of ours who's just returned from the Gaza Strip and is writes frequently of the Palestinian struggle. He is Palestinian. This is somebody, he quotes Sharon's right-hand man in the piece, saying that effectively this whole package that is called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed from our agenda. This is the leadership of the Israeli state here talking. It's been removed from our agenda indefinitely, and all with the U.S. presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. What more could have been anticipated? What more could have been given to the settlers? Any notion that the Palestinians have been given a breathing room or some sort of concessions by the Israeli state is an utter fabrication, and one I don't have time to go into much here. I encourage people to ask questions in the discussion. What I really want to get to is the fact that because the issue of Palestine, certainly in the anti-war movement, has been treated as the third rail of American politics, you dare not raise the issue of Palestine because somehow it will alienate whom we are to ask, presumably racists, and in American politics overall. I think it's something that we have a strong role to play in combating this idea that we cannot talk about the longest ongoing occupation in that region. We need to know the real history behind what Israel is and what it is not, because number one, it's key to understanding the outrage towards the West that exists throughout the Middle East. And secondly, we need to understand, as committed anti-imperialists, that why the tiny state of Israel is such a crucial link in the American imperial project. And let's go back to 1948, not so much because the story begins there, we'll go even further back in this talk, but in 1948, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, on the same time that he declares the independence of the new Jewish state, the state of Israel, the Zionist state, he also declares war on the native population that same time, with the Jews referred to as Hagar HaAtzma'ut. The War of Independence is referred to by the native inhabitants, by the Palestinian people, as the catastrophe, which begins to give you a picture of how, from the very beginning of this state's history, how the two stories have completely diverged. And the fact that when the State of Israel comes about in 1948, it happened on the with the wholesale removal of some 750,000 Palestinian people. In fact, I remember I was raised a Zionist. I went to Jewish school. I went to Hebrew school. I remember my teacher, who was a Yemenite Jew who lived, was born in Israel and lived in Israel, described his family moving into a home that had previously been occupied by Palestinians. It wasn't simply that they moved into an empty home. The table was set in the kitchen and the dishes were in the sink. That is the state in which the Palestinian people fled their homes in 1948 out of sheer terror. Well, the Zionists claim that Israel, for the Jews, was a battle for national liberation. It was, in fact, a national liberation struggle like none other, if, in fact, that's what it was. I would argue it was not. Nothing at all like the struggles against imperialism and colonialism in Africa and in Latin America, in which they sought to throw off the old imperial regimes. In fact, from the very birth of the whole project of Zionism, the Israeli state, and even before it was the Israeli state, the World Zionist Organization, sought to embrace whatever the main imperial power in existence at that time was. It is wholly a project of the major powers from its very inception. Now, the political Zionism is essentially a doctrine which starts from the postulate of the incompatibility of Jews and Gentiles in the world, the notion that that of advocating massive emigration to an underdeveloped country with the establishment of the Jewish state is based upon the notion from the late 19th century that Jews and Gentiles, Jews and non-Jews, would never be able to coexist in any sort of peaceful way. And in fact, most Jews at that time, in the late 19th century, actually lived in what was then Eastern Europe, or part of the Russian Empire. And the large number of the most assimilated Jews into modern societies were located in Western European countries. And many of them assimilated into the political parties. But it's at this time when you actually see an explosion inside of Europe or a shifting of the arrangement inside of even Western Europe, where Jews, in particular in countries like Germany, had been most assimilated. Whereas Jews had previously, in the old feudal order, played roles as sort of middlemen, money exchangers, people in somewhat middle class or trader positions, what often accounts for higher levels of education at that time among Jews, who had to speak many languages because of the roles that they played in that society. All of that arrangement was being destroyed as capitalism, as a new system, as a new means of organizing society, rearranged the way that basically meant that it was no longer a monopoly position for only Jews to be able to hold, and non-Jews for the first time on a large scale were beginning to play these roles as money lenders and artisans. And so most of the European Jewish, which had been mostly a middle class, had plummeted into the ranks of the working class and often blue collar or among the poorest workers in certainly in Eastern Europe. And the atmosphere of despair and depression stirred several responses in the Jewish population, and among them, a growing nationalism. Nathan Weinstock, a man who wrote a brilliant book called Zionism, False Messiah, he says that Jewish nationalism, in particular its Zionist variant, was an absolutely new conception born of the socio-political context of Eastern Europe in the 19th century. Essentially, for centuries, I mean, really in the Bible, there's a notion of, you know, Passover, Jews' Day, you know, next year in Jerusalem, but it's a religious sort of concept that never really held anything much for the majority of Jews. It was not a political concept or a political aim until the late 19th century, when you have, starting with a group of people behind a journalist by the name of Theodor Herzl, who begin to establish this as a political program to put forward of a separate Jewish state, the idea that we need to separate off Jews from the rest of the global population. And this is coming at a time when there was a very famous incident of anti-Semitism that would have been kind of like an O.J. Simpson, only bigger in terms of the case that it was. It was around a Jewish colonel in France, in Paris, and his name was Arthur Dreyfus. And the Dreyfus affair, basically, was a military officer who was framed as a spy, is the upshot of it. And it was a massive outgrowth of anti-Semitism, of riots against Jews in Western Europe in response to this supposed betrayal and treasonous. But there was also correspondingly another response, a response led by men like writers like Emil Zola, who wrote Germinal, among many other books, who led a movement of many of Jews and non-Jews against anti-Semitism, exposing the lies of the French state and exposing the lies of anti-Semitism. But the conclusion that Herzl and the group of people he had organized around him had come to was this, and I'll use his words because I think his words are best at condemning him and his project. He said, "In Paris, I achieved a freer attitude toward anti-Semitism, which I now began to understand historically and to pardon. Above all, I recognized the emptiness and futility of trying to combat anti-Semitism." So the notion that Zionism was about combating anti-Semitism is a complete falsity. It's a non-starter. It was about saying that anti-Semitism comes with the mother's milk, it's inbred in people, and therefore we cannot combat it where we are. We have to remove ourselves and plant ourselves elsewhere in the world. And his pardoning, Herzl's pardoning of anti-Semitism, essentially reflected a core assumption of Zionism, the belief that all non-Jews were anti-Semites. I don't want to, let's see, He basically convenes the first Congress of Zionists in Switzerland in the late 1890s, at which they basically set upon this project. They're going to find somewhere in the world to plant themselves and to gain their state and to go to appeal to the various powers, the British government in particular, to attempt to find a place for themselves. Now, the problem that they have, this is a time of course, the greatest migration of Jews at any point between 1890, essentially, and 1920 is when millions of Jews, there were about some, I don't know, maybe 12 million Jews in all of the world, 6 million of them essentially live in Eastern Europe, most of them living in Russia. About 120,000 of them emigrate to Palestine at this time. More than 3 million, however, emigrate to the United States and to Canada. And there were probably some 12,000 Jews in all that considered themselves part of this Zionist project. And interestingly enough, and I'll talk about this a bit more now, is that there were probably that many Jews in the Lower East Side branch of the Socialist Party in Lower Manhattan. That in fact, it was a minority position among a very small section of world Jewry to believe in this idea that anti-Semitism could not be combated and Jews needed to be removed from the rest of the population and plant themselves in the middle of somewhere else. And actually the majority of Jews, who, as I mentioned before, had been declassed, had become part of the working classes of the world, had actually joined very large numbers of radicalizing working class people were going, and that was inside of socialist and radical organizations. And unlike Herzl and the Zionists, it's worth mentioning that actually the socialists did defend Dreyfus and took part in an active campaign against anti-Semitism, and I won't get into the details of that, but the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD, took quite seriously the need to take up racism, anti-Jewish racism among their ranks as part of the struggle for a united labor fight back against the German ruling class. And what really threw a wrench that appeared to actually be the death knell initially of the whole project of Zionism, who arranged into the whole thing, was the Russian Revolution of 1917. The Russian Revolution of 1917 showed that a socialist strategy for Jewish emancipation, what it meant in practice, that in a country where the Tsar and his henchmen used anti-Semitism to stoke pogroms. Pogroms are basically anti-Jewish riots. Most American Jews of European origin date their family coming here, mine included, to that period of them basically fleeing from these riots. And essentially, in 1917, in a country where I know it's difficult to conceive of, given the modern context of Jews in America, in which Jews were essentially the blacks of Europe, in terms of their treatment, their social status, their language rights, their economic rights, and all the rest of that, essentially they were elected to the leadership positions within the Russian Revolution. Leon Trotsky, probably the most famous of them, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Sverdlov, some of the most famous and powerful in terms of leaders and respected spokespeople for the Bolshevik Party were actually came from among the ranks of the most oppressed, one of the most oppressed ethnic groups from within the Roman, the Tsarist Empire. There was an efflorescence of Yiddish culture, some dozens of newspapers, plays, and this is a language. Yiddish was the language of the Jewish working class. Hebrew, by the way, was the language of basically the biblical scholars and people who were quite wealthy and highly educated. Yiddish was always the language, a sort of an amalgam of languages of Eastern European languages and some Hebrew that that was spoken and is to this day spoken among for elderly Jews. But that was the language of the Jewish working class that had been repressed in every other country by governments and leaders. For the first time, it was actually encouraged, taught in schools. Newspapers written and all the rest of it. So by the 1920s, the Zionist project appeared to be a dead letter, dead in the water. The majority of the world's Jews clearly showed their desire to emigrate to the Western countries, to the United States, and were not looking to Palestine for their salvation. Now, when the Zionist movement embarked on their campaign for a Jewish homeland, they didn't let any sort of ideological attachment or biblical attachment to the ancient Palestine lands from biblical times, you know, get in the way of their project. In fact, they went and looked to Uganda, to other countries in North Africa. Angola was another possible place for them to settle themselves. The idea that sort of Palestine has always been, you know, our land. This is all a bunch of hooey that's been created to justify the repression and the occupation of Palestinian territory. But in fact, they went about shopping for an area in which to control for themselves, and when when it came to seeking imperialist sponsors, the Zionists had really no scruples whatsoever about which regime they were dealing with. In fact, the people that they approached inside of the Russian Empire were among the people who were leading these pogroms, leading these anti-Jewish riots. They went to them to appeal to them. A fellow by the name of Pleb, who at the time was sort of like an Ivan the Terrible. He was somebody who would be conceived of as a sort of a Bull Connor in the 1960s or a George Bush, if you will. If you're a black person today, it would be like going to him to appeal to him for salvation. Those are the people that they went to attempt to get their bit of land in anywhere that they could possibly get it, including a fellow by the name of Lord Balfour, who actually, as his position in the British Parliament, passed a series of anti-Semitic legislation about where Jews can live and language rights and all the rest of that. They appealed to even him, and of course it is his name that appears on the declaration that first gives the Zionists a Jewish settlement, as it was referred to, in Palestine in 1917. And it was quite clear that the people running the British state, which keep in mind, the end of World War I, it's the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the old Turkish Empire, you have the new imperial class, the British ruling class comes in, basically chops up the Middle East. That's the previous history of the Iraqi occupation at this point, is under the British. Well, Palestine was also occupied by the British at this time. And they were looking around for a means through which they could administer this new territory while they were facing guerrilla struggles elsewhere throughout the Middle East. And so when the Zionists appealed to them for a Jewish settlement, it actually came as a little bit of manna from heaven to the British ruling class, to the Winston Churchills, who I believe was the head of the War Department, who was a Tory cabinet minister, who were all openly anti-Semites themselves. All of them had sided with anti-Semitic legislation in the past. What they were interested in is that in the face of the successful revolution in Russia, in which the leadership was known to be Jews around the world, they wanted to erect a right-wing, a reactionary counterweight to the revolutionary example that had been made inside of Russia, and so granted the Jewish settlement under the name of the Balfour Declaration to the Zionists. We'll move on to our story. There's a lot of myths about about the Zionist project. Not the least of them is, although it's become increasingly difficult, I think, to portray any aspect of Israeli society as ever having anything to do with any kind of progressive project, but many believe today that at one point what was a national liberation struggle and a legitimate project for people who were repressed around the world had some sort of progressive content to it. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that there was a very active inside of colonial Palestine, inside of early 20th century Palestine, a very active labor Zionist movement. Now, it wasn't a labor movement in the sense that we think of as a labor movement, one that tries to unite the interests of the entire working class, however feebly they may do it in Britain or France. They nonetheless do, in some distorted way, attempt to represent the interests of the laboring people. What labor Zionism was from the very beginning, and this movement was called, as it is to this day, the Histadrut, it's the name of the labor movement. It's not simply that it's tied to the state, but its actual project from the beginning was not to go in and to unite with the indigenous laborers of the region, but to actually terrorize them and drive the Palestinian laborers, the Arab laborers, out of their job and to take over all industry and all production and all agriculture. And that's the role that the Histadrut, the early Jewish labor movement, played. It never had a progressive content. It didn't become more right-wing. It, from the very beginning, had a project that was wholly racist. The even the kibbutzim movement, which many people, I think progressives in the United States, look to as having, again, a sort of cooperative element. These are, in fact, cooperative of a sort, a very odd sort. They are traded also on the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, I might add, that they produce. They run factories and all the rest of it. But there's a certain image to them, and many American Jews go off to these kibbutzim believing that they are taking part in a sort of collective, collaborative labor enterprise that has some sort of, you know, progressive content to it. You have communal kitchens, you have communal child care, you have, you know, sort of a carpool in which people don't necessarily individually own their own van or VW bug, but it's, you know, you can sign them out and that sort of thing. It has that sort of image to it. In fact, the kibbutzim right from the very beginning were planted as sort of outposts and fortresses, if you will, against, again, the indigenous Palestinian population to try and keep them out of the Jewish areas, and in fact were Jewish only right from the very get-go. The only time that Arabs were ever allowed onto the kibbutzim at all for labor was often at the point of a gun to come in as a sort of a labor, almost like a forced labor workforce. They are no longer allowed onto kibbutzim, and they no longer work. Most Palestinians have essentially been driven out of any kind of useful labor inside of Israel proper, and left with very few, if any, economic opportunities inside of the occupied territories. The kinds of things they did, I mean, they would, you know, they would break strikes if the Arab workers went out on strike. They would terrorize them. The would have now been taken over and given, Zionist coloring, the Yaffa oranges, the fields of olives and dates and oranges that were the heart of much of the Palestinian agricultural industry, were essentially stolen from the Palestinians and at times even bought up. Powerful and well and large Palestinian landowners sold their land to large Jewish organizations like the Jewish National Fund, and then basically replaced the Palestinian labor with Jewish labor. Let's see. And the Zionists essentially, we've all heard this line. It was, I think, made famous by Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel, born here in the United States, actually. She said, you know, for a land, to a land without a people without a land, the notion that that Palestine was simply an empty desert that was taken over. In fact, all of these industries, endless documents, of course you don't read about them in the New York Times. In fact, the amazing thing about what goes on and the complete dispossession of even the history of the Palestinian people in this country is that things that are debated about and written about and talked about in the pages of Haaretz, which is the sort of New York Times of Israel, would never be allowed to be discussed in the pages of the New York Times and the American papers. You're considered an outright anti-Semite if you even talk about or challenge the historical mythology that is put forward as history in this country. And yet even there, in the midst of the repression, this kind of debate in history is openly known and talked about. It is understood that there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living there who were terrorized. And this kind of methods that were used essentially were out and out terrorism. And people like Menachem Begin, former prime minister of Israel, was the head of they were ahead of a terrorist gang, the Stern Gang, the Irgun. They took part in terrorist activities, like in a small town, the most famous of which is Deir Yassin, during the course of the so-called War of Independence, or the catastrophe, in which they lined people up, according to the Red Cross report. There was an independent Red Cross observer there, lined women, children, and men up, and simply shot them, and tortured people, and did it in such a way that people would hear the screams and hear the torture, so that people would simply flee from their homes, and then go into the other towns, tell people what was happening, and then people would leave on their own volition. That's really the usefulness of these kinds of forms of torture. You don't actually have to have the forces to go around and do that to every single person. You simply terrorize a section of the population, and it sets the stage for mayhem, and people evacuate on their own. Let's see. Where do I want to go to here? Okay, I think really without the Holocaust, it's probably indisputable that the state of Israel would not exist. If any one event not simply solidified in the minds not only of the world's Jews, but any of the world's non-Jews, a sort of notion that Jew and Gentile could not coexist, it was surely the concentration camps and the death camps in Nazi Germany. The curious reality behind the relationship of the Zionist leadership and the Nazi relationship, the Nazi leadership, is a relationship that is very little talked about in the history, that is very little acknowledged in this country. In fact, the Zionists recruited immigrants to the State of Israel from among thousands of Holocaust survivors, mostly because most of the European countries and as well as the United States refused to take Jews fleeing from Europe from Nazi prosecution. But actually, what the stance that the Zionist movement took towards the Nazi leadership was actually open and uncompromising collaboration. I'll give a few examples. Where do I want to go here? Okay. This is not where I want to go. I'm sorry. Here we go. A few months after Hitler came to power, the leading German Zionist organization sent a long memo offering formal collaboration to the Nazis. This is what it read. On the foundation of the new state, right, this is the Jews out state, this is in the aftermath of the, in the run-up to the Kristallnacht, the open riots against Jews inside of Germany, when they were basically putting no Jews allowed, et cetera, Jews were losing their jobs from one end of Germany to the other. On this occasion, the Zionist movement sends the letter to the Nazi state. On the foundation of the new state, which has established the principle of race, we wish to fit our community into the total structure so that for us too, in the sphere assigned to us, fruitful activity for the fatherland is possible. For its practical aim, Zionism hopes to be able to win the collaboration, even of a government fundamentally hostile to Jews, because in dealing with the Jewish question, no sentimentalities are involved, but a real problem whose solution interests all peoples, especially the German people. And what they sought to do was take the craven anti-Semitism being used by the Nazi state to basically destroy what had once been the most powerful labor movement and left in Western Europe, to basically use that to catapult themselves greater numbers into Palestine and to actually use it as an excuse to get people to leave Europe and not see the United States as the goal of their immigration, but actually Palestine. And through the 1930s and early 1940s, this kind of collaboration took place. In fact, collaboration meant that leading organizations of Zionism worked to undermine the worldwide anti-German boycott that was called to protest the Nazis' anti-Semitism. Instead, the World Zionist Organization worked out something they called the transfer agreement, by which money from German Jews could be sent to Palestine to finance imports to Germany. So basically, the Zionist state, in order to build itself, was actually getting German Jewish money to purchase goods from the German state, which was the process of annihilation of Jews. So they actually sought to collaborate with the leadership. People have heard of the. Ben Gurion. There was an offer made, basically, by the state of Britain to take some of the children from a particular community in Germany. And this was David Ben-Gurion, before he was prime minister, this was his statement in 1938 about that that proposal by the British government to take Jewish children. If I had known that it was possible to save all the children in Germany by bringing them over to England and only half of them to Israel, then I would opt for the second alternative. For we must weigh not only the life of these children, but also the history of the people of Israel. In other words, at every point, they actually look to do deals, to look to collaborate with the state, with the German state, with the Nazi state, and far from being consistent or committed fighters. Against anti-Semitism or against the impending annihilation of the Jews, they actually collaborated or refused to fight. The Warsaw Ghetto being another time when Jews of Warsaw, Poland, people know the story, encircled behind the walls inside, basically being starved to death, were refused money and arms by what was now a fairly well-funded Zionist organization, basically said, we are not going to fight the Nazis. In fact, they were cutting deals for dozens of, in exchange, would get dozens of Jewish intellectuals, scientists, people who they saw as being people who were in a position to help build the structure of the new Israeli state. They did deals with the German government to get those individuals to be brought to Palestine and to hell with the rest of them. And there's innumerable books and now quotes and things of that nature. I can give people references if you like at the end of this, in which all of this stuff is documented about the dealings between the World Zionist Organization and Antioch. So in terms of even the very thing that many people think of as, at the very least, what Zionism could provide as safety for Jews. Not only is it today probably the most dangerous place in the world for anyone to live inside of the state of Israel, but in fact, even from its origins, it did not have the interest of the actual Jewish population at the heart. And I think we have to ask ourselves the fundamental question, this is where I want to leave the discussion off on, is like, why is it that the United States supports the state of Israel to the tune of several billion dollars, and would say upwards of $5 billion a year if you look at the direct aid and the loan guarantees that are given by this country. And I think there is a myth that about the state of Israel that has to be dispelled, and that's the notion, essentially, that the tail wags the dog. That the reason that the largest, most powerful empire in the world supports a tiny country of some 6.7 million people, which, by the way, has the fourth most powerful armed forces, if you look at the proportions of the population, it is a population that is thoroughly militarized. Everybody, male and female, serves in the military into their 40s, and then well beyond that, doing reserve service into their 50s. It is obviously armed to the teeth with the state-of-the-art weapon systems by the U.S. government, and on and on and on. It does not happen because of the Jewish lobby. It does not happen because American Jews happen to be disproportionately wealthy in comparison to, let's say, the average Baptist. U.S. government policy is not does not exist at the behest of Woody Allen and Steven Spielberg. It simply doesn't operate that way. They may be an interest group that donates quite handsomely through USAID, the Israeli government aid funding, but really it is of tremendous import to the United States to have what is effectively a fairly inexpensive aircraft carrier filled with their paid subordinates planted right there in the middle of the Middle East. Oil, obviously, from the middle of the last century on, has been the very resource upon which the entire world's machinery is quite literally and figuratively moves on. And if the U.S. government were to attempt to have its own troops, can it require tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of troops? Keep in mind, we've had 40,000 troops planted on the border between the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea for some 50 years now, in which there's been no fighting. Imagine the kind of money and troop levels that would have to be maintained inside of the Middle East in order for the United States to be able to maintain their control of what they perceive as their oil, which somehow wound up on other people's sand. And really what we need to understand is that actually it's a pretty good deal for the U.S. government having the state of Israel there. Reagan put it quite well back in the early 80s, and I'll quote him. He said, with a combat experience military, Israel is a force in the Middle East that actually is a benefit to us. If there were not Israel with that force, we'd have to supply that with our own. So this isn't just altruism on our part. And this is the way Israel itself describes its role. This is in their leading newspaper in Haaretz back in the early 1950s when they tried to describe what role that they could play for the emerging American empire, for the new hegemon in the globe. Strengthening Israel helps the Western powers maintain equilibrium and stability in the Middle East. Israel is to become the watchdog. There is no fear that Israel will undertake any aggressive policy toward the Arab states when this would explicitly contradict the wishes of U.S. and Britain. But if for any reasons the Western powers should sometimes wish to close their eyes, Israel could be relied upon to punish one or several neighboring states whose discourtesy to the West went beyond the bounds of the permissible. And in fact, it is that very project, the sort of arming and training of the Guatemalan death squads, the arming and training of the racist apartheid regime in South Africa through decades, that not in addition to the role that they played domestically and regionally of keeping the powers in check, by their successive wars in 1967 and again in 1973, 67 wars when they took control over the Sinai Desert and what is today known as the occupied territories, as well as the Golan Heights, and again in 1973, in which they consolidated that hold, they were able to play the role of effectively pushing back the very powers in the Middle East, in particular in Egypt, in Jordan, and in Syria, that the United States government had every interest in containing and controlling their power. And it was through Israel, through their proxy, Israel, that they were able to do that. And really the turning point was 1967, in which Israel launched a war with Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and stole the territory that I just listed. And I want to quote again from this about the role that the U.S. State Department understood that Israel was playing in 1967. Israel has probably done more for the U.S. and the Middle East in relation to money and effort invested than any of our so-called allies and friends elsewhere around the world since the Second World War. In the Far East, we can get almost nobody to help us in Vietnam. Here, the Israelis won the war single-handedly, have taken us off the hook, and have served our interests as well as theirs. That is how the people in the higher-ups of the U.S. government rule view the role of Israel, and that is surely the way we need to understand the role of Israel. And in fact, if anything, it's since then that the role of Israel has become more important. It's since precisely when the U.S. government was defeated in Vietnam, and it became more complicated, more difficult for them to directly intervene in the doings of countries and other regions that they disagreed with, that they were able to step back and allow the Israeli defense forces or the Mossad, the Israeli CIA, to basically do its dirty work for them. And they continue to play that role to this day. In fact, the saber rattling that is currently taking place against Iran, it is all understood with a wink and a nod that it is unlikely to be the United States government that would be launching anything into Tehran. It is far more likely to come from Tel Aviv. And it's really, I think, and I'll end on this, that I think that it is this role that is a contender. This is, by the way, an argument that is much disagreed with by many, including very, very many Palestinian scholars, people like Ali Abu Nima and people like Rashid Khalidi, who actually argue that it is as a result of powerful Jews and wealthy Jews in the United States that the U.S. government plays the role that it does vis-a-vis Israel. I think they're completely reversing or misunderstanding the actual role of what an empire requires in the region and how Israel, whereas at some point must be held in check as it was during the Gulf War, at other times is quietly allowed to go about its business and basically take care of doing the black ops for the U.S. government. And I think that while it looks quite bleak right now, in terms of the situation for the Palestinian people. And there's no underestimating the devastation that is currently taking place with yours and my tax dollars paying for the obliteration of Palestinian land and lives. I think that we have to remember something that Marx said long ago. He said, history never raises a problem without the corresponding possibility of its own solution. And The thing that we have to understand is that the solution is sometimes not within the boundaries of the state in which the chaos and the mayhem and the bloodshed is taking place, but it is actually going to be a regional solution. It's going to be a global solution for the Palestinian people, which is why the building of this kind of solidarity, the role that we play here as socialists, as radicals, inside of the anti-war movement and inside of the left, of demanding a discussion and a debate and education about the Palestinian struggle and demanding solidarity with the people of Palestine is absolutely paramount for us.